This is an ABC podcast.
Pacific Mornings on ABC Radio Australia.
Oh man, I miss that music. It's so catchy, isn't it? Don't mind me, I'll just dance along to the Pacific Mornings theme tune. But that is right, we are back for 2020. My name is Talia Olatia. And today on the show, we're going to talk more about that movie, Next Goal Wins, a movie that no doubt you're going to hear a lot about this year on Pacific Mornings as I desperately try to interview every single actor and not to mention the director, Taika Waititi. Now, Next Goal Wins is a film based on the 2014 documentary of the same name, and it's about the American Samoa soccer team who suffered the worst loss in World Cup history, losing to Australia 31-0 in 2001, and then their road back to redemption. This is from the original 2014 documentary.
I'm here to play for my country, represent, do my best on the field. You know, I'm here for the love of the game.
I'm just trying to prove we're not the same team anymore. I want to win a game. I would die as a happy person.
That's pretty cool.
American Samoa Warriors, show me how to fight. I'll show you how to win. Come on. Well done.
Now, the new film is currently in post-production, and one player who hit the world stage after the documentary's release is transgender defender Jayat Salua. Coming up on Pacific Mornings, you'll hear more of that interview Richard Ewart did with Jayat on being immortalised in a Taika Waititi-directed Hollywood film, and we'll find out if those soccer skills on set are up to scratch. And as the effects of the Australian bushfires continue to be felt, there's one recognisable face that many Australians are turning to for reassurance. His name is Sean Sweeney. You'll have seen him on TV. He has a really big beard and he's the Auslan interpreter signing for the deaf community.
You've got to remember we're delivering the meaning and the intent and the tone of the speaker. So that's our job, that's our role, is to make sure that the message is getting across to the community. I have moments where while I'm interpreting, for example, Shane Fitzsimmons, was it last week? I think he choked up a little bit when he announced one of the firefighters had passed away. And I had to really compose myself and not choke up as well, because I take on the emotion of this speaker, because I have to, because I'm interpreting the meaning.
You'll hear more about Sean Sweeney and his life-saving work coming up on Pacific Mornings. And also, it's a jam-packed show. There's just so much that we're talking about that I forget all the things. But we're also going to find out how a New Zealand university is using maths modelling in the hope of saving endangered languages like Te Reo Māori. We know that 2019 was the year of Indigenous languages and there was a real spotlight on saving these endangered languages. And so some very clever mathematicians using modelling that I probably do not understand and will never understand have run through the figures. And coming up later on Pacific Mornings, we'll tell you what they've found and what it could mean for endangered languages around the world. But next, there's a new documentary that's putting the focus on logging in Papua New Guinea.
Pacific Mornings.
Now, people caged in shipping containers for protesting deforestation, workers paid less than $100 a year, polluted waters causing widespread sickness amongst young children. These are just some of the abuses that the UK-based group Sarawak report claims the people of PNG are suffering at the hands of Malaysian logging companies in a new documentary.
It's Southeast Asia's hidden scandal, Malaysia's dirty secret. The once pristine vast island of Papua New Guinea has been captured by timber raiders. They came from Sarawak and are closely tied to the present governor of that East Malaysian state, Abdul Taib Mahmud.
Now, the documentary is called Malaysian Colonialism in Papua New Guinea and claims locals have seen little benefit from the almost 5 million hectares of timber taken from their land. And at times, they say these remote communities are left worse off. Journalist Claire Rucastle-Brown travelled to Papua New Guinea to investigate the story and spoke to our reporter Priyanka Srinivasan.
Well, it was really fascinating. Nothing beats really getting down on the ground and making the effort to go up and meet people, often in very remote areas, because these are the people who are being affected. And so often we just don't hear from them and we don't hear their stories. And by making that effort, really, I felt the whole picture fell into place. I got the evidence from people's own stories, from their own mouths, as to how these incredibly wealthy companies have been deliberately and ruthlessly moving in on their lands and ripping out billions and billions of dollars worth of timber, for which no recompense has gone back to the people. So it was a really interesting investigation, and I hope that, you know, it provides some evidence for some of the new government actors who are looking at this problem now in Papua New Guinea.
Mm. And you talk about hearing people from the community sharing their experiences and their own voice. One of the most, I guess, confronting things that I heard when I saw the film was some people claiming to be imprisoned in shipping containers when they were protesting the logging happening on their land.
They stood with posters, peaceful protest, but they got the police and the police arrested all of them and locked them up in the container for 7 days. The containers were made purposely to store cargo, not human beings. It is closed all around, and people were locked up in there, and they were there, left in the dark.
So that was quite a confronting thing to hear there. Are authorities looking into these alleged abuses, Claire?
Yeah, I you can imagine how incredibly shocked I was, and then increasingly so, because I went to several communities where this practice was described to me. This is common practice. And you can see why it's evolved, because nobody's putting any infrastructure and very little building is going in, certainly very little solid building into these communities. But one thing that's knocking all over Papua New Guinea are shipping containers. These are being used to take materials in and out. And these Malaysian companies, they have the names of the companies blazoned over the outside of these containers. And they're just being reused as convenient holding prisons at all the logging camps. So that's the punishment cell if anybody gets out of line. It's really shocking. They get, you know, driven in there at the point of a gun and you know, the conditions, I can hardly bear to talk about it. They're put in there for days at a time without food and water in the blazing sun.
And did you come across, you know, there police or government officials that knew that this was taking place? Did any of the people who went through this themselves go to the police at all?
There seems to be a problem that's well known about. And the trouble is, of course, it's been condoned by the government. I came across this problem, this system, actually, back in Malaysia. They call them auxiliary police. The logging companies use this whole system in Malaysia, where basically there's a delegation of authority to sort of semi-official police forces out in the remote areas who are being paid for and funded by the logging companies themselves. So therefore, they're effectively not working for the community. They're not working for the government. They're enforcing for the paymasters, who are the logging companies.
And one of those logging companies is Rubunan Hijau, which is one of the biggest in Papua New Guinea, if not the biggest. Yeah. Now, they say that they, you know, on their website, they're quite open, saying that they help build roads, like you said, contribute to development, contribute to schools, healthcare centres in the area, you know, help develop these communities. What did you find any evidence of that, or did you speak to the companies themselves and how they defended their practices?
Well, do what I did and take a little tour up to see the schools and healthcare centres and villages, which are appalling. You know, this has been a smash and grab raid, and look, I'm saying it, but others far more believable, perhaps, and with authority than myself has said it too. And there have been, for example, the Barnett Report, which was a report conducted some decades ago now by a very respected Australian judge, described Rimbunan Hijau and the other logging companies as robber barons who had bribed and exploited their way into a rape of the country. This practice has just continued. And yes, obviously it is a systematic subversion of decision makers. So you're seeing corruption at the highest levels. We're talking about enormous sums of money to buy politicians, to buy decision makers. who have then sold out their communities effectively. That's what I trace in the film, bit by bit. We talk to all the people in the chain, right up to some of the political figures who have emerged as being involved in some of these companies. And I tried to knock on the door of the timber companies down there on the ground and to speak to the forestry officials who have also been supervising this. Nobody wanted to talk to me.
Hmm. And, you know, on that, you seem to detail this quite ingrained corruption, I guess, in these communities through your documentary. Are you calling for international action? What are the communities themselves calling for as well?
Well, I think it's very unanimous, actually, within the communities. That was one of the very interesting things I found. Yes, I mean, marvellous promises were made when the loggers arrived. It's so easy, isn't it, to say we're going to make, you know, we're going to give you the lifestyle that if you go down to the town, you see on TV. Of course, they don't. And so there's massive disillusionment and really a growing fury at ground level and amongst the workers I spoke to against these Malaysian loggers. They know they've been had, they know they've been played, and they know their politicians have let them down and that their politicians are very rich men and that they have nothing. So there's an awareness now on the ground. And also I think that has played into an awareness that there needs to be change at government level in Papua New Guinea. There has been a recent change of government. Peter O'Neill was chucked out last year and the reforming government, you know, the new government says that it has a reforming agenda as far as corruption is concerned. And I think, yes, the international community should be ready, should they get reached out to do what we can to support Papua New Guinea in going after these enormous companies who have taken billions of dollars worth of timber out of their country and paid virtually nothing back. I mean, the biggest irony of all this, and it happened in Sarawak as well, is that these companies officially operate at a loss. So they have been putting in, you know, no taxes because they've been pretending they've been doing this for charity for all these years. That, you know, that should be looked into. You know, there are lots of ways that these companies ought to be brought to book.
That was journalist Claire Rucastle-Brown speaking there to ABC's Priyanka Srinivasan. And the full documentary is available to watch on YouTube. It's called Malaysian Colonialism in Papua New Guinea. Neville Coop is the director of Nandraki Weather and joins us now for a weather update. Hello, Neville.
Hi, Talia.
Now, Neville, last week when we spoke, we were looking at two potential cyclones that are around the Pacific, one around Solomon's to Vanuatu and the other in Fiji. How are they? I know that there was a case that they were just potential cyclones, but any update on if they are going to evolve and how they're tracking?
Yes, well, let me start at the outset by just talking about the bigger scale picture, which is the monsoon, which is now really well established right from Indonesia right across to Fiji. We do have a lot of rain. We've had record rainfalls across the top end of Australia, 24-hour records set, upwards of 500 millimetres in a day. That monsoon is pushing across PNG and the Solomons and now into waters north of Fiji. So we have a tropical disturbance that is currently located over northern Vanuatu near the Torres and Banks Islands. It's pretty weak and indistinct at the moment, but it is forecast to strengthen, and that's the system that we're going to be concerned about later this week. Currently, it's not yet a cyclone, it's still a tropical disturbance, but all the forecast guidance suggests it will become strong cyclone, perhaps a severe cyclone by about Wednesday, and then it just seems to be on a beeline that's going to take it directly over Fiji, perhaps early hours of Friday morning.
Okay, interesting. And no doubt you'll be keeping us updated here on Pacific Mornings with what is happening with those disturbances as they develop. How else is weather looking around the region for today, Neville?
Well, one of the key things we're looking at right now is the strength of the monsoon winds across Papua New Guinea and into the Solomons. You may remember some years ago we had the incident with the MV Rabaul Queen, the ferry that was lost at sea in a very strong monsoonal gale. and that's setting up similar right now. It's this time of the year, a lot of people travelling in PNGs. They come, kids come back to school, so we want to watch that. Also, the same monsoonal winds are going to produce quite heavy swells for Tuvalu, and being low-lying atolls, they can be inundated when they get these heavy swells, particularly as we're just coming out of a full moon. So the seas, the high tides combined with the high swells will perhaps lead to sea flooding for many of the atolls of Tuvalu, and then later on in the week for Tokelau and parts of Samoa.
Well, Neville, thank you so much for the update. No doubt you'll be posting news as it happens on your website and Facebook page.
Yes, certainly on our Facebook page. We don't run much on our website, but certainly if you want to check out our Facebook page, that's where everything is.
Excellent. Neville, thank you so much for the update, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
Thank you, Talia.
Thank you. That was Neville Coop there. He's the director of Nandraki Weather. And like you said, you can check out their Facebook page for more updates about what the weather is doing around the Pacific region. That Facebook page is at Nandraki Weather. Nandraki spelt N-A-D-R-A-K-I. Time to find out some of the stories making news today. And to do that, we're joined by Marla Damati. Hello, Marla.
Good morning.
Now, over the weekend, Tonga didn't pay its bills and it's lost its voting rights in the UN. Why is that?
That is right. Tonga is actually one of seven countries to lose their votes at the United Nations General Assembly because, like you said, it hasn't paid its fees. The UN said that there were actually seven countries that were so far behind in paying their dues that they were losing their voting privileges in the 193-member General Assembly. The seven countries are Tonga, Venezuela, Lebanon, Lesotho, Gambia, Central African Republic, and Yemen. Look, the payment is about US terms $16,000, and that would be enough for Tonga to regain its voting privileges.
So it's not like it's been officially kicked out and they have to go through the whole process
again.
Exactly. It's just like, it's like
pay their dues,
pay your rent, and the power comes back on. And when we say power, we mean voting privileges.
Correct.
Let's go to a blacklist in France because of a handful of Pacific Island countries have been placed on a blacklist in France. Who's blacklisted and what are they blacklisted for, Marla?
So Fiji, Vanuatu, Guam, Samoa, and American Samoa have been added to France's blacklist. And this blacklist is of non-cooperative countries and territories in fiscal matters. Now, these countries have been found to not be respecting criteria in matters of fiscal transparency and the fight against the erosion of the tax base. Paris updates this list annually, and it now comprises of about 13 countries. However, France has removed Niue, Nauru, and the Marshall Islands from the blacklist after they agreed to comply with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, provisions, which also apply to France.
It sounds like France is like a parent and like the blacklisting is telling these like countries, you're in the naughty corner. You need to pick up your game. And then once you do it, you know, you'll get to watch TV at nighttime or something like that. Your privileges will be renewed. And finally, Marla, the mayor of Paris, speaking about France, has decided to name one of its streets after a music legend. Who is the artist who gets the honour of having a street named after them in Paris?
I'm going to play a little bit and let's see if you can figure it out.
But the film is a sad thing for.
Is it David Bowie?
It is David Bowie. A Paris street will soon be named after the late British rock star David Bowie, which the local mayor announced on Friday. There will soon be a Rue David Bowie in the 13th arrondissement of Paris, said Jérôme Cormier, who's the mayor of Paris. He's actually a professed fan of David Bowie, who died in 2016. And he said the new road near the major station in the southeast of France capital would bear the name of the music megastar. But the name actually has to still be approved by the Paris Council in Feb, but he says it normally happens without any problems. So who knows, next time you or I or whoever in the Pacific is in France, they can visit Rue David Bowie.
It's so funny because there are so many David Bowie songs that are about like a location. So you could just imagine all the jokes that will come up when Rua David Bowie comes up, like, you know, Under Pressure. We're under pressure that we are lost, or like Where Are We Now? Remember that song from David Bowie? Or If You Can See Me. Like, there would just be so many fun David Bowie songs that you can sing on Rua David Bowie. I wonder if they're going to have like speakers pumping out his music or anything
so.
Like that.
I hope so. It makes me want to go to France even more than I already do.
Just to check it out. Marla, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
My pleasure.
That was Marla Damati there with some of the stories making news today.
Australia Calling is a new documentary that explores the history of the ABC's international broadcasting. Covering wars, earthquakes, and regime changes across the Asia Pacific, Australia Calling explores the forces that shape Australia's international broadcasting services. To catch Australia Calling, tune in on ABC Australia TV on Friday, December 20, or watch it on ABC Australia iView.
Friday, December 20 has very much long and gone, so you can't catch it live on Friday, December 20. We're not talking about December 20, 2020. I might have to retire that promo. But like you heard, if you missed it, you can still hear that or watch that Radio Australia documentary, Australia Calling, on ABC iView. It is well worth a watch, and it actually features some of my colleagues here in ABC Radio Australia. I was actually in Europe when the film documentaries came around, so I didn't have to be a part of it. But producer Marla does make an appearance in the documentary Australia Calling, and you can check it out on ABC iView.
Pacific Mornings
on ABC Radio Australia.
The Hollywood remake of Next Goal wins the award-winning documentary about the American Samoan soccer team and their first ever World Cup win back in 2011 has gone into post-production. Directed by New Zealand's Taika Waititi, the new movie is described as a comedy drama, but one that is true to the spirit of the original story. News of American Samoa's landmark win over Tonga went around the globe, and the documentary catapulted one player in particular onto the world stage, the transgender defender Jaya Salua. She has spent time on the set in Hawaii and came face to face with the actor who plays her in this Hollywood film. Richard Ewart asked Jaya what she makes of the way the movie is shaping up, and as long as people recognise that it's not the documentary, she believes that people will appreciate the new version of this American Samoa story.
I do know that the true essence of what the documentary presented is there in the remake. It's just a hybrid version of the documentary. Some true events are left out, and then some were altered to make them more entertaining. And I think that Taika has been doing a really good job in, you know, maintaining the true essence of our story.
Tell me a little bit about the actor that plays you, Kaimana.
Oh my gosh. You know, my biggest concern a few years back when I met Taika and Steve and Mike, who are the directors of the documentary, when I first heard that Taika wanted to do a remake of the documentary, my biggest concern was who was going to play me. And then I met her, and she's such a sweet girl. She's fierce. She's a new actress, and I think this film will introduce her to a lot more opportunities for her to, you know, pursue an acting career. Her energy is the same as mine, and that's what I like about it. Originally, I wanted someone who knew me personally, but I think it was a concern of Taika's to not have someone who knew me so that it doesn't get in the way of his version of me. So it was very reassuring the moment I met her and actually talking to her and hearing about her own personal stories. And a part of her portraying me is trying to portray the person as true as she can, but it's also putting in part of herself. So yeah, I love that it's Kaimana.
So tell me, how does she compare as a footballer?
She's not a footballer at all. They had to do a lot of training. I will say, the non-football scenes, she nailed it. There was a scene where she had to do the Jaya slide tackle, and I felt bad watching her do it over and over and over again. But I appreciate that they did that. They had to do it a number of times in order to get it as a fierce, clean tackle. And yeah, she's not a footballer. A lot of the boys in the film are not footballers as well. But I know that it's a film about football, but I think all the editing and stuff will make them look as good as we think we are.
I should point out, for those who aren't familiar with the story, I mean, the slide tackle that you refer to was critical to American Samoa getting their first ever World Cup qualifying win. And effectively, you prevented a goal.
Right. Otherwise, it would have been a tie with Tonga. And that last minute slide tackle essentially saved our team. It secured our win, our first ever win. And I think that's why Taika wanted to get as perfect as possible.
Taika is on record. In fact, I've heard an interview where he said he would not have cast any actor other than a transgendered actor to play the role. I mean, was right. that important to you?
It was very important to me, but I think it's more important to the transgender community as a whole to be able to be portrayed by another trans person. I think that's what all films should be. And I think Hollywood is making moves to, you know, make sure that not only trans people, but any minority is represented correctly. And if you know Taika, he's passionate about representation. And I knew from the very get-go that he was going to pick someone who is transgender to portray me.
He is, of course, big business at the moment. I mean, Jojo Rabbit was up for various awards at the Golden Globes just a few days ago. Uh-huh. So, I mean, this film is going to bring a lot of attention to American Samoa and a lot of attention to the story of you and your teammates mm-hmm. from 2011. Yeah. What do you think the impact might be in terms of awareness about the country, but also awareness perhaps about football in the Pacific?
I know the documentary has brought some attention to football in American Samoa and the region, but Hollywood is a completely different playing field, and this will pretty much blow up our story. I think it'll help the image of football in the region. It'll help the world understand why we play here. It's all about the love of football and our passion to play and our passion to grow despite the lack of resources and the lack of funding. I think people will start to understand that more about football and about the region. And I think it'll bring a lot of bigger countries who have more established football associations. It'll bring them back to the true essence of why they began playing in the first place, because they love the sport. Aside from that, we're hoping that it'll help bring more resources that will help develop football here in the region.
One thing I should have asked you a little earlier, talking about Kaimana taking your role, I mean, my understanding is that you were in the running to play yourself. How close did that come to happening?
Well, the casting agents reached out to me and pitched to me the idea of me playing myself. A lot of my friends as well suggested the idea, but I wasn't comfortable playing myself. Not only because I knew that it was going to be Taika's version of myself, and I'm also not a camera person. It's a lot more pressure than the documentary was, because the cameras were far away and half the time we didn't even realize that they were filming. The remake is a completely different thing where you have to act and you have to do what Taika says. And I don't think I would have been good enough for the part. The football, I know I would have.
Of course.
I know I would have performed perfectly, but, you know, everything else, I don't think I could have pulled it off as much as Kaimana did.
That was American Samoa's Jaya Salua, the only transgendered international soccer player in the world, made famous in the documentary Next Goal Wins, and set now for an even bigger dose of fame when the Hollywood version of the story hits the big screen later this year.
Big Ideas on ABC Radio Australia.
If you're like me, you might start each new year with some firm resolutions. Exercise more. Cut back on the booze. But the research shows most of those resolutions are out the window by mid-February. Why is changing your behaviour so difficult, even if you know it's good for you?
I think that all of the challenges facing our society today is absolutely dependent on changing human behaviour.
Big Ideas explores some of the monumental challenges of our time.
What's the best way to protect human rights and freedoms? The Americans have a Bill of Rights hardwired into their constitution. The European Union has the European Convention. In Australia, well, at a federal level, we don't have either. So do we need one?
Big Ideas, Tuesday till Friday from 2 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Talia Ollett here, and that's all for this half hour of Pacific Mornings. But when we come back, you'll hear about the life-saving work translator Sean Sweeney is doing for Australia's deaf community during these bushfires.
For me, it's all about delivering to the community, making sure the community understands what's going on, because for deaf people, it's more stressful for them not knowing. And as you would appreciate, if you don't know what's going on, you would go through a massive amount of anxiety, your mental health gets attacked, and the list just goes on.
You'll also hear how a New Zealand university is using maths modelling in the hope of saving endangered languages like Te Reo Māori. News is next, and then it's Pacific Beat with Catherine Grau, and then I'll be back in half an hour for more Pacific Mornings. Catch you then.
Pacific Mornings on ABC Radio Australia. Kaki te mō whiti māre nā I ngā kiri ātā Ko tāku kainga he whakamā Aue! Rohe pohara Rohe rā wakore Ki ngā waiata Rehi tikwa kauranga tani whāmone
Tā lofa lava, my name is Talia Olatia and you're listening to Pacific Mornings here on ABC Radio Australia. Now, in the middle of Australia's bushfire crisis, some faces have become quite recognisable. And the man with the long salt and pepper coloured beard standing next to politicians and emergency leaders signing for the deaf community is one of them. His name is Sean Sweeney, and he is an Auslan interpreter signing for the deaf. Sean Sweeney comes from a long line of family members who are deaf and has worked as an interpreter since 2000. Now, during emergencies like Australia's bushfire crisis, Auslan interpreters like Sean are heavily relied upon to translate life-saving, up-to-date emergency information to Australia's deaf community. Coming up this half hour of Pacific Mornings, you'll meet Sean as he explains the very important work that he does. And talking about languages, mathematicians at Canterbury University in New Zealand have been crunching the numbers in efforts to save Te Reo Māori. You'll find out what they found coming up on Pacific Mornings. Those stories and more with me, Talia Olatia.
Big Ideas on Radio Australia.
Covering more than 30% of the Earth's surface, the Pacific Ocean is the largest water mass on the planet. But this huge body of water is stressed. Issues of overfishing, marine pollution, and coastal erosion are exacerbated by the impact of climate change.
Big Ideas explores some of the monumental challenges of our time.
Climate change is only just starting to show its effect here in the Pacific. We're seeing small changes, but not really dramatic changes, whereas the storm on the horizon is that it's approaching. It's going to get much worse. And during that period, we have to start to look at the domestic issues around the world. Things like overfishing, things like runoff from the catchments, the whole ridge to reef type approach.
Big Ideas, Tuesday to Friday from 2 p.m. on Radio Australia.
Pacific Mornings.
Now, last year, 2019, was the year of Indigenous language. And we talked a lot on Pacific Mornings about the importance of preserving and saving Indigenous languages. More than a third of the world's languages are currently classified as endangered, and more than half are expected to go extinct by 2100. It's so weird to see that, to see the year 2100 and not really even know how to say it. Now, we hear hear a lot about endangered languages from, you know, a cultural and linguistics point of view, but now let's look at it through a mathematical gaze. Researchers at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand looked at how to prevent endangered languages from disappearing. Using Te Reo Māori as a case study, they developed a mathematical model that can predict the trajectory of an endangered language and were able to quantify how much effort is needed to save that language. I can't even begin to explain how impressed I am that people can actually do this kind of work. Now, Michael Plank is a co-author of the study and is an applied mathematician at the University of Canterbury and joins me now. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Talia.
Now, we normally think of maths as being very separate from language or language studies. So how do these two fields work together?
Well, it really boils down to the number of people speaking a language. I mean, a language is in danger if the number of people speaking it gets too low. And so what we did was we used some mathematical modelling techniques based on how many people are speaking the language currently, to try and project that forward in time. So it's all about whether things are going upwards or going downwards, and using some of the tools of mathematics to try and predict what will happen in the future.
So tell me about these models and your research and what tools you used and what you found.
Yeah, we were interested in the processes of language transmission and language learning, and comparing what's happening with Te Reo Māori with other languages around the world. We hit upon Welsh as a good example of a language that was in decline for a long period of time, but more recently has seen a range of revitalization initiatives and a resurgence in the number of speakers. So we were interested in what we could learn about the outlook for Te Reo Māori from this situation in Wales.
And so what did you find?
Well, we found that the number of people who can speak Welsh is on a reasonably healthy looking upward trajectory. That doesn't mean there's no danger for the language. The recovery is still very much in its early stages, and so it's still very fragile. For Te Reo Māori, the data we used was from the 2008-2013 censuses, so it's a few years old now. But what we found was that if things continued as they were at that time, then Te Reo Māori would be on a downward trajectory. Fortunately, we have seen a number of revitalization initiatives in New Zealand since then, so hopefully these are starting to reverse that trend. But I think we need to do more, and we need to, most importantly, keep collecting good quality data to monitor how this is going.
When it comes to revitalization techniques for preserving languages, are there some techniques that you've proven are more successful than others?
Well, we found that one of the most important factors in language recovery is the number of really proficient speakers who are capable of teaching the language to others. You need those really proficient speakers in order to be able to pass the language on and keep the language alive in the long term. So as well as enabling people to learn the basics of a language, it's really important to be conscious of that pool of proficient speakers and teachers. And so any language revitalization initiatives really need to sort of revolve around that pool of teachers and how you're utilising that limited resource.
Mm. Does age come into effect when it comes to learning languages? My mum's Italian, my dad's Samoan, I can't speak either, and I blame my parents saying that you should have taught me when I was younger because it's harder to learn a language when you're older. Is that actually true?
I'm sure it is. I think it's like anything. It's easy to learn when you're young and it gets harder as you get older. And that, I think the same goes for learning anything, really, not just languages, but for sure, you know, kids' brains are just really wired for learning, and so they can definitely pick these things up a lot quicker when they're young.
Mm. So in an ideal world, if you had some specialised Māori teachers teaching a concentrated group of the younger generation Māori, does that increase its likelihood that the language can be saved moving forward?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, one of the things we found was that with the limited pool of Māori teachers in New Zealand, it's important to prioritise learning by Māori to a proficient level. I think there's a bit of a danger that if you try and roll language programmes out to the whole population, you actually end up spreading those precious teachers too thin, and you don't get people up to that really proficient level that you need to be able to then pass the language on going forward.
And what's the reaction been to the research that you've done?
There's been we've had a few bits of interest from the media. There's been a few media stories in Wales, so there's a bit of interest picked up on the Welsh story, and there's been a bit of interest here in New Zealand. I think it's starting a few conversations, so it's early days, but hopefully there'll be it'll stimulate a few ideas and maybe thinking about how we can best save the language.
Mm. Has there been any indication from like the New Zealand government that they might take up your recommendations?
Not directly. I think it's probably perhaps a bit early for that, but I am in contact with some people at the Ministry of Education, and hopefully this will be the start of some conversations going forward.
Absolutely. So where to next for both your, your math modelling and the preservation of language?
I think in terms of the mathematical modelling, we'd like to sort of delve into a bit more of the details of different strategies, different sort of things you could try to try and increase those learning rates and try and get that upward trajectory going. As I mentioned earlier, getting good quality data is a big part of that. So really monitoring how many people are speaking the language, how many people are learning the language, as you say, at what age, monitoring those sorts of things and collecting that data over a period of time will really help us to gauge the health of the language and how that's changing.
What I know, it sounds so pessimistic, but like, what would a world without te reo Māori look like for New Zealand?
I think it would be extremely sad. It's one of the things that makes New Zealand unique. It's a huge cultural importance to Māori, and it'd be extremely sad and a huge loss if the language went extinct.
Mm. It always sounds like such a fatalistic question when you ask, what happens if it doesn't happen? But, people need to understand what the repercussions of the consequences are when language is not saved and what that would look like. Mm-hmm. Michael, if people want to find out more about your study, where can they go?
They can download the paper. It is there is a freely available version that people can download and read. There's links on our webpages as well. So they can find it that way. Yeah,
absolutely, at the University of Canterbury. Michael, thank you so much for your time and for joining Pacific Mornings. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thank you. That was Michael Plank there. He's an applied mathematician at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. And that report that they wrote is available on the Royal Society webpage. The report title is, and excuse my terrible, if you thought I couldn't speak Italian or Samoan, I definitely can't speak Māori, so excuse my terrible pronunciation. But the report title is called Ki Kaua Te Reo Erite Ki Te Moa Ka Naro, Do Not Let the Language Suffer the Same Fate as the Moa. But if you just go to any search engine and type in Te Reo Māori and University of Canterbury, I'm sure you'll be able to be directed to that report, which, as you heard from Michael, is doing really important work when it comes to saving endangered languages.
ABC Radio Australia, for arts and culture.
The artist Ryan Presley has wasted no time in the past 30 years. His wide-ranging artistic practice covers art forms like watercolour, oil painting, printmaking.
So a lot of the artefacts simply disappeared into the rich houses of Europe, mainly. Even where they were preserved and perhaps later on sent to the museum in Naples, they're exactly...
ABC Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Mornings. My name is Talia Olatia. Coming up, the interview with Auslan interpreter Sean Sweeney. He spoke to ABC reporter Harriet Tatham, and as I was editing the interview to play for you on Pacific Mornings, I learned so much about the work that interpreters do when it comes to translating that important information for the deaf community. So that interview is coming up shortly. But how about a little bit of music for your Monday morning? This is Mae Moa. The song is Kawea. Moa there with a song, Kawea.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +614 375 19 385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +614 375 19 385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Mornings. My name is Talia Olatia. When you turn on the TV to be updated on the New South Wales bushfires, a face that you'll consistently see there with the Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, or Rural Fire Service Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons, is Sean Sweeney. He is an Auslan, or Australian Sign Language interpreter, providing life-saving information to Australia's deaf community. For months, Mr. Sweeney and a small group of interpreters have been working to ensure the deaf community can access up-to-date emergency information. Sean himself comes from a long line of family members who are deaf. In fact, his first signed word was bottle when he was just a baby. However, Sean didn't start working as an interpreter until he was in his late 30s. ABC reporter Harriet Tatham spoke to Sean Sweeney about his work and what it's like to be an interpreter.
G'day, my name's Sean Sweeney. I'm the Auslan interpreter at the RFS Emergency Announcements.
So, Sean, what's your story? Tell me, how did you first get into signing and interpreting?
How did I get into interpreting? My whole family's deaf. I come from a long line of deaf generations. Goes right back to my great-grandparents, my grandparents, my parents, aunties, uncles, cousins, second cousins, blah, 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 blah. So I'm the first one born in my family who is not deaf in my mother's bloodline, and that's how I got into interpreting.
Why and when did you become an interpreter?
I became an interpreter because I had a bit of a midlife crisis in my mid-30s, and I was looking for a new job. I got made redundant in my old job, and I was approached by my sister who asked me whether I was interested in becoming an interpreter, and I laughed at her and I said, nah, I'm not going to become an interpreter. And then I, you know, went back home that night and I had a bit of a think about it. And then I thought, you know what, I'll give it a go. And that happened in, what was it, year 2000 that happened. And that's when I became an interpreter.
So we see you on our TV screens all the time, standing up there next to the Premier, next to the RFS Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons. How do you actually do what you do? And that maybe sounds like a crazy question, but run me through, like, do you prepare for it? Are you doing it on the spot? You know, what's your thought process?
Okay, what I usually do is that I look for all the prep I can find before I go into a job. So, for example, I will look to the ABC. I'd look at their 24 hours news channel. They're completely updated with all the, you know, fire emergencies that are happening around the state. I listen to the radio. I've got that going in my car the whole time. I look at the RFS Fires Near Me app, I look at live traffic. So I go into the job fully prepared in my mind, knowing what's going to happen. And when I arrive at the RFS headquarters, I usually ask the media team, what are they going to talk about? And usually, you know, the head of media, Greg, he comes up to me and he says, oh, okay, Sean, you're going to talk about X, Y, Z. And so in my head, I've got to get a visual as to what's happening in the state. So, for example, you know, if they're talking about Sydney fires, I set myself up in, you know, where's Sydney, and then I work out where all the major towns are down the coast, and then that's how I interpret. So I need to have prep before I actually go into the job. We don't actually interpret word for word. What we're doing is interpreting meaning. It's two completely different languages. It's not a literal translation. What we do is that we do an interpretation. So there's a difference between translation and interpretation. You've got to remember, we're delivering the meaning and the intent and the tone of the speaker. So that's our job. That's our role, is to make sure that the message is getting across to the community.
It appears to me sometimes when you're interpreting, you are actually conveying the emotion. You know, when the Premier was reporting that, you know, there were some deaths, you could see in the way that you were moving and you were doing, you know, holding your heart and whatnot, you know, you're kind of conveying, that part of the role of an interpreter?
Absolutely. Our role as the interpreter is to deliver the meaning and the intent and the tone. So I have moments where while I'm interpreting, for example, Shane Fitzsimmons, was it last week? I think he choked up a little bit when he announced one of the firefighters had passed away. And I had to really compose myself and not choke up as well, because I take on the emotion of this speaker, because I have to, because I'm interpreting the meaning and I'm interpreting the intent and the tone, and that's what happens.
Sean, as I know from reporting on the fires, there's some tricky pronunciations in terms of towns and, you know, places that people may have not heard of. Is there a rule when talking about places and, you know, the way that you... You know, talk about those to people?
Of course. The rules around it are that we fingerspell the nouns. So in other words, if, you know, of a place, of an address, of a name is usually fingerspelled. But if they're rattling off, you know, 20 towns in 20 seconds, there's no way I'll be able to keep up with every single town. So what I do is I generally, you know, pick out the major towns. So let's say, for example, Batemans Bay. So I have a sign for Batemans Bay. I generally fingerspell it at first. Then I use the sign and then I'd refer to the region. And generally, when they're rattling off the towns, they're rattling off all the towns for that particular region. So that's how I get away with it.
What's it been like for the last 3 weeks? I mean, as a reporter at the ABC, we've found it all pretty you know, it's a stressful time. It's a distressing time. What's it been like being on TV every hour of almost every day?
Look, for me, stress, has it been stressful for me as an interpreter? Yes, it has been. Delivering the messages, you know, making sure the intent's there. Listening to the emotion and listening to the way the emergency is being announced, I can see why people, you know, raise the awareness and understand the stressful behind it, the stressness behind the meaning. For me, it's all about delivering to the community, making sure the community understands what's going on, because for deaf people, it's more stressful for them not knowing. And as you would appreciate, if you don't know what's going on, you would go through a massive amount of anxiety, your mental health gets attacked, and the list just goes on. So that's why it's really important for me to deliver the right message.
How else can deaf people in the community actually get access to that emergency info?
Well, there are different ways of getting information. It's all about communication. Captions is one option, but it's only one option. You've got to remember, as a person, you would rather receive your information in your first language. You don't want to be reading about it, because you miss out on the tone, you miss out on the delivery, and all the intonations within the person delivering the message. So it's really important for people to receive emergency warnings in their first language.
Is it a rewarding job?
Oh, is it rewarding? I love it. I love it. I don't work. It's something I just do. I'm very, very lucky that I get paid to do this job. And you know what? And when you're getting praised every single day of your life from the community that you love, I mean, what more can I say?
That was Auslan interpreter Sean Sweeney talking to ABC's Harriet Tatham there. And there is an online article of that interview with Sean Sweeney that Harriet's written. It's on the ABC News website. It's called Auslan Interpreters Save Lives in Bushfires, but only if they make the TV screen. And that's because deaf advocate and founder of Auslan Media Access, Shirley Liu, said while the deaf community appreciated the work of interpreters, news organisers often cropped out Auslan interpreters out of the shot in favour of highlighting the key speaker. She says that we need to ensure that the Auslan interpreters are shown, because if they're cut out of the footage, it means deaf people miss out. And as you heard from Sean just then, that information is so important, especially in times of emergency.
Pacific Mornings
on ABC Radio Australia.
Let's squeeze in a little bit more music before we say goodbye. This is Baker Boy. The song is Black Magic.
Black magic, either you do or don't have it. Young, black and gifted, talking the whole package. Magic, magic, life's camera action. You are now witnessing the power. So what? Reminiscing, chilling, fishing, laying down ice cold. Sticky, mission, twisting, flipping, spinning. You're my saga, representing Arakumala. This is how I wanna live. I'm welcome, Marga, Tuka, proud. Nina, Yapa, Ali, Black Magic. Either you do or don't have it. Young, black, and gifted, talking the whole package. Magic, magic, life, camera, action. You are now witnessing the power of Black Magic. When we gonna see another Mabo? Someone who really cares about tomorrow, not about where to get his next Badu. We need more Kathy Freemans, possibly more Freeman. These days blacks getting locked up for no reason. Archie wrote them while I'm preaching. Arms for the beggar man, they took our children away apparently for the better man. Now they take our land, big money for the settlement. Kevin Rudd said sorry and they thought that it was settled. But that ain't settled shit, middle finger to politicians. The day I listen will be the day that I see a difference. Our people in Windham gonna see Kafanova prison. They think that it's living, but it isn't. See a
different vision. Young, black and talented, we all fit the description. What a time to be alive, boy, I die for my district. Vivid picture, the lyrical, not maturing, and I'm pointing at my skin. Nicki Wiman, boy, you know I'm black magic.
Either you do or don't have it. Young, black and gifted, talking the whole package. Magic, magic, life's camera action. You are now witnessing the power of black magic.
Black skin, white skin, centuries fighting. Straight to the point like I just stuck the knife in.
Throw me to the bush, come out as a warrior. Put me in the city, come out as a prime minister.
If you don't wanna close the gap, then close your gap. Heat a combo, I'm cold like that.
What a tune. That was Baker Boy there featuring Dallas Woods with the song Black Magic. That is all for Pacific Mornings for today, the first Pacific Mornings for 2020. It's good to be back. Don't forget that Richard Ewart will be along for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. You can catch him from 3 p.m. PNG time. Enjoy your day and I'll be back tomorrow for more Pacific Mornings. Catch you then.